Hi, this is Doug Henwood. My Behind the News show for October 13, 2005 was a special fundraising edition. It ran for 3 hours, but about half of that was taken up with fundraising appeals. I figured the web audience would not want to listen to that, so I'm just presenting the individual interviews themselves that constituted the bulk of the substance of the show. The three guests were Robert Greenstein of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, based in Washington, D.C., Beverly Wright, the director of the Deep South Institute for Environmental Justice in Louisiana, and George Galloway, the British Member of Parliament, who recently debated Christopher Hitchens in New York, who in May confronted Norm Coleman and his colleagues in the U.S. Senate, giving them a very hard time about the war in Iraq, and is also the author of the book Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington, which recently came out from the New Press. Here is the interview with George Galloway. All right, welcome to WBAI, George Galloway. How are you finding your tour to America so far?
Well, marvelous. There's a terrific audience, I think, for anti-war arguments, to learn of the experience of the anti-war movement in Britain and the experience of progressive people trying to make political change in a country like Britain, which is, of course, an ancient imperial power and now the number one auxiliary to American imperial power. Oscar Wilde once said we were two countries divided by a common language. We're trying to bridge that division.
I think a lot of people here were surprised by the kind of lèse majesté you showed the Senate committee. People here just don't talk like that. American political discourse is extremely constrained. Are you surprised at all by the level of popular consciousness among the Americans you've met so far?
No, I'm greatly encouraged by it. I knew that it existed because I have an enormous postbag from the United States. After the Senate confrontation, for example, I got more than 22,000 emails from all over the U.S., and some of them written in very unconstrained terms. Yours being a family show, I'll not go into details, but the American people are not as buttoned up as their political system would imply. And it is rather unusual that a country as big and bold and brash and can-do as the United States should have a buttoned-up and increasingly threadbare political class. It's one of the great paradoxes of our time, and one which I hope you would resolve sometime soon, because when I got up close and personal with the U.S. Senate, I discovered that Senator Norman Coleman, the man who was chairing the committee before which I appeared, actually entertained serious thoughts about being the President of the United States. And frankly, he makes George Bush look like Aristotle. So it struck me as bizarre, actually, grotesque even, that such flimsy figures as Coleman and Bush can be serious presidential hopefuls in this political system.
Well, things are so bad here that even Bill Clinton looks good in retrospect in some ways.
Yeah, come back, Bill Clinton, all is forgiven. Come back, Richard Nixon, all is forgiven. You see, Richard Nixon was a scheming, duplicitous, twisted individual, but he was a calculating man who seriously calculated the consequences of his actions, certainly his foreign actions. He would not have done anything as reckless, I think, as George W. Bush did, it would appear, hardly a moment's thought.
All right, let's talk a bit about your deep friendship with Saddam Hussein, as your enemies like to portray it. You met with Saddam, I think, as you put it, about the same number of times that Donald Rumsfeld did.
Exactly the same number,
twice. Well, tell us about those meetings.
Well, I met him once in 1994, along with a large number of other people. I met him with a delegation of European parliamentarians, retired generals, and other grandees, mainly from the mainland of Europe. And so I didn't get much face time with him then, just a few minutes, 2 minutes, me face to face, and a little bit more than that in a speech which I was selected to make. The only other time I met him was in August of 2002, when I had a long talk with him, some of it just me and him and Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister, deputy prime minister, who translated the meeting, and Mr. Naji Sabri, who was the foreign minister of Iraq at the time. So four of us, everyone else dismissed. We had a long face-to-face, tete-a-tete, serious discussion about what Iraq needed to do to get out from under, to try and avoid this devastating disaster that has, in fact, taken place.
In the book, you describe a rather dramatic scenario of joining up with Saddam for that meeting, being ferried about in vehicles, transferred, and taking a deep elevator ride into the bowels of the earth. Tell us about what that felt like.
Well, one is summoned to see dictators like Saddam Hussein at very unusual times. And in my case, on this occasion, it was the crack of dawn. A uniformed emissary appeared at my hotel room door and asked me to dress quickly and come. I knew, of course, that was a summons to the president. I myself had asked for a meeting with the president to discuss this Hans Blix weapons inspector question. I hadn't seen him since 94, between 94 and 2002, but I was determined to see him on that occasion. And I was taken in one curtained, window-darkened Mercedes car to another, from one anonymous building to another. I kept expecting that the president would walk in, but it was always just another driver, another car, another anonymous building, until finally we got to one and, as you say, descended into the bowels of the earth in an elevator. And there, under the ground, had been recreated what appeared to be a presidential palace hall. It was only a room, but to the viewer of television, it would appear that the meeting had taken place in a presidential palace. But in fact, it was the recreation of the reception hall of a presidential palace.
When was
this? Under the ground. This was in August 2002.
So about 6 months before the war.
Yes. And I went there to try to persuade him to allow Blix and the arms inspectors back. I was one of those who successfully convinced him to do that, and a fat lot of good it did, because it's now clear that Bush and Blair had already decided to invade Iraq, irrespective of anything the Iraqi leadership did.
You describe yourself as actually having been convinced by the intelligence experts that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. How'd that happen?
Well, it wasn't really that I was intellectually convinced. It was that the sheer scale of the propaganda offensive made me doubt that it could possibly be true that there was absolutely no trace of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And when I talked to Saddam on that occasion, especially in the tete-a-tete bit, when I more or less implied that he'd been lying in the earlier, more public part of the meeting, saying, look, you can tell me the truth, you can talk the truth to me, because I'm trying to help Iraq to avoid this disaster. And I'm telling you, you have to let Blix in, you have to cooperate with him, you have to destroy any and all weapons material that you've got, and so on and so on. He let me speak, and then he fixed me in the eye. And he said, Mr. George, we know everything that you have done to try and get the Iraqi people out of this terrible situation that they are in. We would not lie to you. I'm telling you, we do not have weapons of mass destruction. And as I say in the book, my heart sank actually at that answer, because I thought, my God, he's still lying, and even lying to me, and even at this 11th hour. But it turned out that it was the dictator who was telling the truth, and the so-called democratic leaders of the free world who were doing the lying.
And he was very strangely flattering to you about British culture and British politics. First of all, tell us what that was about, but what do you think? Did he think he really meant it, or was he just flattering you?
No, I think he kind of meant it, because it is a very unusual thing. Wherever I go, in the British Empire, as was, I often find myself as the only anti-imperialist in the room. I go to Palestine, I go to India, Pakistan, parts of Africa, and so on, and I hear them talking about the imperialist era in ways that I would never contemplate talking myself, or even sit at a table and listen to at home. And in Iraq, exactly the same is true. Despite the fact that Britain was the colonial power, despite the fact that Britain looted the country, despite the fact that thousands of British soldiers were killed in the ending of the British occupation of Iraq, and all the twists and turns of Britain's relationship with Iraq, the level of Anglophilia is very, very high. And the plugs are the same, the buses are the same, the measurements and weights are the same. 1 million Iraqis a year used to go to London for their holidays. There were something like 4 Iraqi Airways flights a day to London before the sanctions. The relationship between Iraq and Britain is historically very close and deep. It's really difficult for Iraqis to understand why Britain sacrificed its position in Iraq, and for that matter in other Arab countries, for the purposes of following George W. Bush over a cliff. After all, Britain has gained absolutely nothing from this enterprise. Halliburton and Bechtel and these other corporations have gained a very great deal. They've taken a lot of money from the US taxpayer and from the Iraqis. But British companies have obtained virtually nothing from the Iraq enterprise and are not likely to. And Mr. Blair has destroyed his political reputation. He will be remembered historically for nothing other than having led Britain into the war in Iraq on a pack of lies, which turned out to be a bloody disaster. So actually, it's difficult for Iraqis and difficult for many people in Britain to understand just why he did that. Saddam has the view, again, I'm afraid to say, it's a view that's shared by many, but not by me, that America is Rome and Britain is Greece. Britain is the older, more civilized, more sophisticated power that can whisper in the ear of the new brute Roman American Empire. And the belief that somebody like Mr. Blair or someone like Britain can really guide and may even be guiding, may even be manipulating. This is the line of the likes of Lyndon LaRouche and others, that actually Britain is the mastermind, the maestro behind all of this, and the poor Americans are being worked from behind like a kind of glove puppet. It's all nonsense, of course. Britain is not Greece. America is not Rome. In any case, we have no influence over America at all. Absolutely none. I mean, look how our people were treated in New Orleans. So much for the special relationship. Yet, special relationship is the sort of Monica Lewinsky relationship, which requires the weaker partner to always be on their knees, serving the stronger partner, I'm afraid to say, if that's not too colourful a metaphor for your family show. The idea that Britain is a civilizing influence on the United States is rubbish. First of all, we don't have any real influence, and secondly, if we did, it wouldn't be a civilizing one.
I do want to return to the issue of what Britain gets out of this in a moment, but first of all, the attitude that Saddam displayed, the Anglophilia you describe, in Iraq and also elsewhere in the Arab world, is this some sort of psychopathology, a post-colonial psychopathology, or is there something else to it? What do you make of it?
It's partly clutching at straws, but it is a psychopathology. It is colonized mentality. It's one of the reasons, for example, as we're having quite a serious conversation, I can go into this. It's one of the reasons why so many Muslims don't believe that Muslims were responsible for 9/11. They spin all these absurd conspiracy theories that, you know, Bush did it, the Zionists did it, they knew it was coming, they arranged it. And
that's popular to some of our loonier people on the left.
Well, it's very popular. It's widely popular in the United States, and it's completely preposterous rubbish. But it's virtually universally the view of Muslims. And one of the reasons why is that they don't believe that Muslims could have carried out such a sophisticated act as 9/11, as successfully as the dastardly murder of 3,000 people was. This is, again, a sign of almost self-hatred, a sense of inferiority, of unworthiness, and the superiority of the foreigner, the Khawaja in Arabic, is widely believed by many Arabs and, frankly, many people from formerly colonized countries, yourselves being an exception, perhaps because you so long ago slipped the colonial yoke, that somehow the white man is top dog because he is top dog.
It's a constantly mystery to me precisely what Britain gets out of being so servile to U.S. interests. Is it some way to play empire kind of in the slipstream of American power? Is that what it is? Or is there something else we're missing here?
Maybe it's a reverse psychopathology. I don't know. It's out of my... it's above my pay scale to analyze it. But I suspect that it is the sense that if you can't be the head of the dog, at least be its tail. It's the rat following the elephant for droppings. It's the weakling running around with the school bully, threatening everyone with somebody else's army. It's a very humiliating pass to which we've come. Mr. Blair openly threatens people in the world with somebody else's army. Now, the last man who did that with regularity was Mussolini, who used to threaten people with Hitler's army. Now, Blair is not Mussolini and Bush is not Hitler. But nonetheless, the analogy is illuminating, I think, because it describes the way in which Mr. Blair sees our future. You see, he said that we were going to be at the heart of Europe, but instead we've become a cancer at the heart of Europe. We're a Trojan horse in Europe, acting for American interests, as a ramp for American interests, against the development of more and more successful European unity. He once said to me in a private conversation, which I shouldn't really divulge, given the kind of house rules, but he once said to me that when I asked him about the special relationship and British foreign policy, he answered that the special relationship is British foreign policy, and that the special relationship, and I'm quoting him directly, allowed us to punch above our weight in international affairs and in European Union affairs. Of course, I did ask him why he needed to punch at all, but made the point to him, and it's my view, that the precise opposite is true. We actually have virtually no influence in Europe precisely because we are half in, half out, half looking across the Atlantic several thousand miles and half looking 21 miles across the English Channel to the European mainland.
Yeah, as you say, Britain has no influence over the United States. So despite the notion of punching above the country's weight is preposterous. It's just a kind of a service force for the U.S.
No, it's like Monica Lewinsky thinking she was influencing American policy. Well, I'm sorry, you are not, and Britain is not.
A lot of us here think of the British system, political system, as somehow more open, more flexible, more responsive, somewhat more democratic in ways than ours is. But on the other hand, it does look like British popular opinion was even more firmly against the war in Iraq than here. What is it about the British political system that allows Blair to pursue these deeply unpopular policies? Is it as rigid and as undemocratic as ours is?
Well, I think it's more complicated than it looks. There are some things in which the people of the United States are better off in terms of their democratic rights, their constitution, their constitutional rights, freedoms and protections enshrined in law, their Freedom of Information Act, which is a real one, unlike ours, which is a completely phony one and only just been introduced after 10 years almost of trying. And a manifesto pledge to introduce it. You have primaries in your election system, which we don't have, and I think that that's an underappreciated virtue that you have. You have the ability, if you organize yourselves, to really influence who runs for the big parties in the elections. We don't have anything like that. We are prisoners of an elective dictatorship in the form of Mr. Blair, who is a president who doesn't stand for election as a president, but who effectively rules as a president. The Queen has no importance in the British Constitution, and Parliament has virtually no importance now in the British Constitution. The party wins the election, its leader becomes effectively the president. And when you have a president with Bonapartist ambition to control like Blair does, that's a very dangerous prescription, and we have no constitution to fall back on. You, on the other hand, have certain protections. On the other hand, our political system is not as corrupted by money as yours is. You have to raise $1 billion or more to successfully run for the presidency of the United States. Nobody can raise $1 billion or more unless they're raising it from corporate interest. And corporate interest requires you to follow the corporate agenda, which means that the parameters of the two main parties in the U.S. duopoly are absurdly narrow, and no one can step outside of them. And if they do, they are destroyed. We don't have that same problem. There are very severe limits on expenditure in British elections, and I commend that system to you. We don't allow political advertising on television, for example, and I commend that to you also. And therefore, money has not yet bought the British political system to the same degree as it has bought and sold the American system. Equally, although we have some of the worst newspapers in the world, we also have some of the best. And those newspapers, even some of them controlled by the same foreign owners who own the worst papers, continue to allow us occasionally to see some light through the fog and to expose malfeasance and wrongdoing on the part of the political leadership. And that's a precious democratic freedom that we still have, and I think it's better than yours. Well, I must say, when I look at the American media, I'm, first of all, bored stiff, because it's extremely badly presented and I think prolixly written material for the most part. I'm talking about the serious papers. But they're also unbelievably timid and reactive and uninvestigative. It's hard to believe I'm in the land of Woodward and Bernstein when I see the level of U.S. journalistic reportage.
Well, let's turn to some less pleasant and more controversial topics. You've been criticized, for flattering dictators. Christopher Hitchens made a big deal out of some comments you made in Syria about Baby Assad there. How do you plead to these criticisms?
Well, actually, what I said about Assad is exactly what Tony Blair said about him. So I plead the British Prime Minister in defense. Mr. Blair brought Bashar al-Assad to Britain 2 years ago and forced the Queen to have tea with him. In fact, forced the Queen to put him up for the night in Buckingham Palace. So the British government believed, and I believe, that Bashar al-Assad is a step forward from the father, Hafez al-Assad. He's, of course, a dictator. Every Arab ruler is a dictator, either a puppet president or a corrupt king, or a president who might want to be a puppet but isn't yet one, or has been a puppet and has broken loose, or originally broke loose and is now a puppet in the form of Gaddafi. All of them, from the Atlantic to the Gulf, without exception now that Arafat has gone, are effectively dictators, one system or another. So that notwithstanding, Bashar al-Assad is a modernizing, reforming president who is changing things in Syria. He has a long way to go. I said so to him and publicly. Mr. Hitchens, of course, didn't quote that. I said it in every broadcast about the need to press on faster and harder with the reforming agenda, with the democratizing agenda. He didn't mention that either. But I have to tell you, you have to start learning to be careful what you wish for. If Bashar al-Assad were to fall tomorrow, he would fall to a Zarqawi-type Islamic fundamentalist dictatorship, not to a democracy. And that would not actually be in your interests, or I believe in the long-term interests of the Syrian people.
And then, relatedly, you've been criticized for being a bit too much of a cheerleader for the insurgency in Iraq and overlooking its targeting of civilians and its fondness for Islamic law and such. How do you plead on that?
Well, actually, the people who are fondest of Islamic law are the people that Britain and America have put into power in Iraq. I can assure you that the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the leader of the Shia community in Iraq, quite strongly believes in Islam. And quite strongly believes in Sharia and the concept of an Islamic republic. I, in any case, take the view that the political stripe of the government of Iraq is nothing to do with me or with respect of you. I gave the analogy that the Irish revolutionaries who rose in 1916 and seized the General Post Office in O'Connell Street and declared the Irish Republic were routinely denounced by the Christopher Hitchens of their day as priest-ridden, bog-trotting, Gaelic, Celtic obscurantists, and they were refused a certificate of good behaviour by the English liberals at the time, but of course the only certificate that mattered was the certificate to be issued by the Irish people, not the people of the occupation force. And so it's none of your business or mine what the politics of the emerging power in Iraq is. But what I refuse to countenance are the following. First, the characterization of the Iraqi resistance as being foreign fighters. It's first of all an absurdity, logically, for people with names like Rumsfeld and General Myers and the other British and American commanders to be talking about foreign fighters. The greatest number of foreign fighters there are in Iraq are wearing British and American uniforms. They're much more foreign than Arabs who've come from neighboring Arab countries to help Iraq fight against its occupier. Second, the distortion of the character of the Iraqi resistance as Islamist fundamentalist to the core. That's not true. It's much more complicated than that. There are people in the Iraqi resistance who are secular nationalists. There are people who are Sunni Muslim fanatics. There are people who are fighting only because their street was badly treated by the American army when they arrived. There are people fighting because their family was dishonored, because their mother's jewelry was stolen by a soldier. There are people fighting because their uncle was sodomized for the benefit of the pornographic filmmakers in Abu Ghraib. There are people fighting for all sorts of reasons. They are by no means all Islamic fundamentalists, Islamist fundamentalists, and they're certainly not foreign. The United States itself is no longer claiming that they are foreign. The United States itself accepts that the vast majority of people in the Iraqi resistance are Iraqis. And they are Iraqis, moreover, of quite widely divergent political stripe. Now, there is an international legal right on all occupied people to resist militarily their occupiers. Under the Geneva Convention, under all international law, the Iraqi people have a right to fight their occupiers. And they appear to be availing themselves of that right without any encouragement from me. I support their right to do so, as I support the right of any occupied people to resist their occupiers. That does not mean that I support every one of them, every group of them, and certainly not every action of them. As my comrade Tariq Ali said in one of his books, if occupation is ugly, how can resistance be pretty? And the occupation is, believe me, very, very ugly. And the resistance to it will be ugly. And sometimes spectacularly ugly. Sometimes even uglier than the occupation. But that does not invalidate the right of the Iraqi people to resist their occupation. And I do my talking to my friends in Iraq. I encourage them always, publicly and privately, to stand against any action against civilians, against people on a confessional basis. For example, the targeting of Shiite worshippers in a mosque is not only morally reprehensible, it is utterly counterproductive to any project of building a national resistance capable of overthrowing the puppet regime and its colonial backers. Which begs the question, who's really doing these kind of operations? Now, I'm not one of, as you'll have gathered from earlier, I'm not one of life's conspiracy theorists. In fact, there's scarcely a conspiracy theory anywhere that I've ever agreed with. But anyone who's read Graham Greene's Quiet American or seen the movie with Michael Caine knows that occupation armies and occupation forces, their secret special forces, very frequently carry out provocations which appear to be the work of others and which have the purpose and usually achieve the purpose of serving the interests of the occupation. The Americans did it in Vietnam, and the spectacular example in the Quiet American I've just given you. Others, Britain included, have done it in different times. I don't know who carries out some of these operations. If it is someone who believes that they are fighting for the liberation of Iraq, they're sadly mistaken. They're making the liberation of Iraq less likely, not more likely. Quite apart from committing an act of reprehensible cruelty, which is unjustifiable by anybody. So that's my stand. I don't believe that the Iraqi resistance is a terrorist force. I don't believe that it's an Islamist fundamentalist force, even though there are terrorist acts committed by some who are, some of them, Islamist fundamentalists. In the end, I believe that the American Revolution deserved the support of people like me at the time, irrespective of the fact that America would later turn out to be run by crazed fundamentalists like Pat Robertson and George W. Bush. That was not a reason for opposing the freedom of the colony from its colonial occupier, and neither is the conduct of some strands of the Iraqi resistance a reason for supporting the foreign occupation of Iraq.
The occupation doesn't look like it's going very well in political or military terms. It seems that opposition to the war is rising in the United States. It doesn't look that there's any way that the U.S. and its shrinking coalition of the willing can win a political or military victory in Iraq. Where do you see this going? I mean, it's not exactly a part of the world the U.S. can easily abandon for the oil resources. There's also, you know, this perpetual concern about maintaining your imperial credibility. So if you leave Iraq after having put so much at stake over it, you'll look like a very weakened imperial power. So where do you see this going in the coming months and years?
Well, if I hated America, which I don't, and if I hated or cared nothing about the Iraqis, which isn't true either, I would urge you to stay in Iraq. Because as long as you're in Iraq, you're not going anywhere else. As long as you're in Iraq, your credibility, to use your term, as an imperial power, is seeping into the sand at quite a rate of knots. As long as you're in Iraq, you're bogged down and your power is bleeding away. Your standing in the world is bleeding away. So if I hated America, I'd actually be saying, tell you what, why don't you send more soldiers to Iraq? But because I don't hate America, and even more because I certainly don't hate the Iraqis who are suffering in all of this maelstrom, I strongly urge you to leave. If you don't leave now in good order, you will leave one day in disorder, in the way that the Americans left Vietnam, with the ambassador clambering on board a helicopter, his papers scattering in the tail draft, and being whisked away moments ahead of the wrath of the Vietnamese people charging up the stairs after him. If that's a dramatic presentation which shocks your listeners, I'm sorry. But that's how it will end if you don't end it now or soon. The Iraqi resistance is unbeatable. You cannot defeat them. The vast majority of Iraqis support the Iraqi resistance, and that's before the Shiite masses fully join in to that resistance. You're one fatwa away from a disaster. People ask me, will America take action against Iran, or will Israel take action against Iran? I say, well, if they do, they're committing suicide in Iraq, because Iran is now a very powerful force in Iraq, and if it gives the word and its supporters join the Iraqi resistance, then you'll need an airlift. You'll need a Berlin-style airlift to get your soldiers out of Iraq, short of a massacre. I'm talking a real massacre. You cannot defeat the Iraqi resistance, even before it has fully become a national resistance. So it would be wise to begin talking, and if you want my honest opinion, I think you're already talking to the people you need to talk to, but you need to talk to them seriously. You need to work out what needs to be done to achieve some kind of end to this enterprise, which minimizes the ignominy which the United States will face, but nonetheless satisfies the basic requirements of the Iraqi resistance, which is the removal of the foreign occupation forces from the country. I believe that these discussions are already underway. I can't go into details about how I know that and what I know, but they're not serious at the moment, and they need to become serious.